Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Systems Change Deep Dive podcast, where we're taking a systemic look at some of the greatest social, economic, and environmental challenges that we are facing as a global community, and where we also take a look at the ideas and projects that have the potential to catalyze the systems change that we need. Currently, we are looking into the issue of carbon capture as a response to the climate crisis, and we have been hearing from experts from around the world throughout the last episodes who are working on different types of approaches and solutions to carbon capture, carbon removal, and beyond. Today, we have with us Julian Ikelhoff, who is an expert in the fields of corporate social responsibility, sustainable business development, climate action, and creating ecologically, socially, and economically sound nature-based projects. He is the Senior Director of Climate Solutions at Four Lions, connecting their work on corporate climate strategies with implementation and financing of international forest carbon projects. He has worked in this field for more than a decade, having experienced all the different phases of carbon markets and how they have impacted the work on local socioeconomic impacts in the partner projects that they work with. As by training, he's a sports economist. So this professional path was not really a predetermined thing, but the transition from sporting goods industry to social impacts of sport NGOs to the relevance of international climate action for socioeconomic development always seemed natural. And in addition to his daily work at Four Lions, Julian is pushing the need for climate action also as a speaker at international conferences, as an author of articles, and as a member of working groups, expert panels, and award juries. So welcome, Julian. Thank you so much for being here today. And I'd like to kickstart this interview by asking you the same question, the same first question that I've been asking everyone, which is, what inspired you or what drew you to do this type of work?
Thanks for having me, first of all. Very nice to be here. The motivation, I guess, generally speaking, is fairly straightforward, that obviously the challenge that we are trying to address with these activities is a very, very present and a very, very crucial and also an extremely urgent one. And in the work that I've done also before, and that we as a company and in the early years of this organization we've done, was always connected to this topic, but not necessarily really focusing on it, and still it seemed like me and us, we kept coming back to this point of really the climate impacts of those activities. And so it just seemed obvious to recognize that and to really put the full focus on addressing these issues while doing it in a way that still brings along with it very clearly the socioeconomic and ecological aspects, of course, of climate action.
Yeah, that's great. Also, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your approach to the issue of carbon capture. How are you, this whole process of working with nature-based projects?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, as you say correctly, we as Four Lions, we are focusing completely on the nature-based area of this, which of course doesn't mean that the other approaches are not valid or just as important as well, but we just feel like this is a topic that is so complex that it requires quite a level of expertise, and so that we should specialize on this and really do the best work we can do in this area. And so with the nature-based projects, the carbon capture or the carbon removal of growing ecosystems, of increasing biomass, of growing forests is really a crucial one, and it is at this point the most efficient way to address this, to not just avoid emissions but to actively remove emissions as well. And so that is the one part that we see here, and again, other really interesting technologies are evolving, but at this point that is the biggest joker basically we have in this topic. And that comes along with the other impacts that already were mentioned, of course, in the space, where it's not just about reducing or removing carbon emissions, but it is for the people and the regions that are actively involved in those projects. It is much more about the other impacts that those projects obviously bring. And for example, carbon credits are then the the unit to support those activities, but in the end, what is happening on the ground has a lot of impacts that locally are much more relevant, at least in the local perception, of course, than the actual climate action effects. And so we basically try to build natural carbon sinks in a sustainable way. We always say we are not planting trees, but we are creating forests and growing forests, which is like sometimes, of course, there's a big overlap, but we really try to take the long-term view, and it's not about planting as many trees as we can today, just to count the trees, but really to build those ecosystems for the long run and to build them for decades and many, many generations in a way that having those intact ecosystems and thus those intact carbon sinks is the most impactful way also locally, instead of just a nice action you can do today and talk about, and it sounds nice, but nobody really knows what happens with it in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I really like that approach to thinking in the long term, in the long run, and how you can keep an ecosystem alive and well, working for many years to do carbon removal. We found for lions through the Sodombo reforestation project. So I was wondering, why did you end up working in this area with this community? How did this come about?
Mm-hmm. Now, we actually started working with them more than a decade ago, or basically a decade ago now, when they started focusing on this topic. And it's exactly the type of cooperation and partnership that we always try to build, where we work with partners on the ground who really understand the communities, who understand very well the local situation, who understand the livelihoods in the areas that this project is implemented in. But what they didn't have necessarily is the technical knowledge around how to develop, for example, a carbon project, how to go through the process of a certification, how to arrange and secure the finance that you can get internationally by corporates deciding to voluntarily support such activities based on the climate impacts that it's generating. And so we built this partnership there with the local organizations of World Vision Ethiopia, and then in partnership with World Vision Australia, who are pushing much of this work forward very actively as well. And that was the combination that we built, where we had developed a number of forest carbon projects in the past, and we came in contact with them, and they said what they had in mind and what they were missing kind of to do this. And that was, again, exactly the type of approach that we try to do, because we cannot obviously as an organization understand the very relevant details of how the communities are structured and how to build those long-term positive impacts, as well as an organization who's worked in that area for many decades, basically. So when we came across this situation and we had the first discussions with them, it was very quickly very obvious for both sides that this would be a partnership that makes a lot of sense in order to achieve what we try to achieve.
And I have to ask, I'm curious if, so you are working with local organizations, how are the community, are the communities receptive to these types of projects, these types of partnerships?
I mean, if you do it right, they are, and that's exactly the point, right? So you cannot come in and say, hey, we are doing a forest carbon project now. There was no forest before, there will be a forest now, deal with it. That is not, if you take that approach, obviously either there will be very quickly no forest anymore, or you will have basically very, very low acceptance locally. And so that's exactly the point of understanding. And there's a lot of work that goes in, and that's something that people sometimes underestimate in terms of, hey, I have some area here, I would like to do a reforestation project, when can I start? And it's usually like a number of years sometimes, even before you can actually start the real activities, because you need to do this work. You need to talk to the communities. You need to understand. And when we talk later about the approach of the specific project, it is where you have a situation where you try to change the way that the land is used and you try to turn it into a more beneficial situation. But of course, there are very valid reasons why it was used differently before, for example, for cattle grazing and for different activities. And you cannot just say, hey, we change everything now, how you do things here. And so that is the work that needs to be done. And then it is perceived very positively when we visited the project, a couple of years ago, it was amazing to see that they were so happy that we were there, but not because they could say thank you, but because they were so proud to demonstrate what they had achieved locally, right? It was really nice that you're here. Now we can show you what we're doing and how well it is working. And it was a real sense of pride that it was their project and not, oh yes, thank you so much for supporting us. We would have never been able to do that alone. It's the opposite. And that was really, really impressive to see if you approach it this way, to really involve them in the process. And there's a lot of decision-making processes where they really influence how the project is managed because they see the positive impacts. But that's not easy to do. That takes a lot of work. But if you put in that work, we really see that those projects are perceived very, very positively, obviously, on the ground.
Yeah, it's great to hear that. And also, this ties in with my next question, which is, how do you feel that the projects have benefited the well-being of the local communities? So you have already mentioned that they have this feeling of that the project that they're developing is meaningful and they're proud of. They create a sense of pride and motivation, I guess. But I bet there are other things as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are very, very very objective elements, of course, of how it is benefiting and the systems that are built, where maybe to just to take one quick step back to the basic logic, to look at the basic logic, where it's about regenerating forests, where the tree roots and so on are still there underground, and it's about regenerating those and not planting new trees necessarily, but more allowing the remains of what was previously a forest to regenerate naturally, and to do that by including the farmers, which leads to the term farmer managed natural regeneration, which is the key technical approach of this project, which leads to areas being regenerated as forests. And then of course it's about a combination of two things, how that creates positive results, which on the one side is the forest itself in terms of their seed materials that actually today are distributed and sold all over Ethiopia to other projects that try to do regeneration and planting activities. It changes really the local microclimate, which is always amazing to see what an impact a forest can have on the surrounding areas. One very important element there was also that there was a lot of erosion. It's especially the Zodo location is on very mountainous terrain. So it's basically on the slopes of a mountain where the communities are around the mountain. And so since the forest is there, there's much, much fewer landslides, for example. And that really has an impact on those communities as well. So it's really about the positive impacts of the forest itself. In addition to also ecotourism, for example, there's a very, very diverse bird population. And it's a niche part, but it's a really relevant part where people go there to experience those birds. And then there's the indirect impacts where the carbon project part comes in, right? Where for the positive carbon capture effects of this forest, this is being financed then internationally with the voluntary contributions from international companies and organizations. And then this revenue is then used for those additional impacts, like they were building additional tree nurseries, they initiated honey production, so there's apiculture in the project. There's also fruit tree nurseries. They built new flour mills in the project. And so the revenue that comes in as a result of this carbon removal effect generates those additional livelihoods. So it's really this combined element of the forest itself and then the revenue coming in that allows the partners there and the communities to build those additional livelihoods that they were not able to do before, but also that will be self-sustaining in the long term, right? So it is required to have this initial push, but then once the forest is established and once those livelihoods is established, then we can really phase out the carbon finance and those things will sustain themselves. And that's the approach. And so far that is actually much more successful even than it was we hoped for in the beginning. So we hope to continue down that path and also expand and scale that to many additional areas in Ethiopia and in other countries as well.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear about the whole in-depth regeneration and actually hear that you are focusing first on the soil itself, regenerating the soil first, then the forest, and everything comes gradually, not starting with the carbon markets just off the bat, and maybe scaring people a little bit. What is this? What do they want to do? We don't. What is this new thing that we've never heard about, and now someone comes here and wants to come and implement it here. So one other thing that I want to ask is if there is any educational component to the activities that you are doing in the project.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, a combination of things. So one part, and I wouldn't necessarily call that educational, that is more part of the project setup, where in order to govern and coordinate that project locally, the local partners together with the communities, they build the cooperative structures and then also the union structures. So the communities and the farmers are organized in cooperatives, and then the cooperatives amongst each other build unions. And this is basically then the decision-making process and basically a democratic structure that is built to coordinate those activities and other things that the communities are doing together in the region. And that is something that was built in order to make the project, the carbon project, possible, but also now is doing a lot of other things in those communities to improve the decision-making processes amongst each other. But that is more, I would say, a structural thing rather than maybe an educational thing. And in terms of trainings that are done, there are a number of trainings each year for all the cooperative members. There was a lot of training to be done, obviously, about forest management, about sustainable forest management, about how to prune trees, how to do enrichment plantings, and so the whole forest, the forest management. And another thing that I really like about the specific project is, where in other projects it would be usually us coming in and doing, for example, forest monitorings, doing carbon calculations, going with the auditor to the field to take the measurements to see how the project has grown and to do things like biodiversity monitorings, water quality, and so on. All of that is done with the local communities in this project. So they are trained mostly by World Vision Ethiopia on these topics. So they do their own forest monitoring, they do their own biodiversity monitorings, and so on. And that is really also amazing to see that they drive this project and they monitor the positive impacts of the project themselves. So that is more the technical part of it. And then again, there's obviously the topic in terms of how the revenue is used, that there's, I would say the more traditional, maybe social impact, such as building a new school for the community, basically, especially on the higher mountain areas, where usually it was very difficult for the children to go down and then go to another school, which is just an enormous trip for them. And so there was a new school built, especially for those communities. And we tried to make it up there, but we actually didn't manage, just because it was really such a demanding hike, basically. So that gave us a pretty good idea of how necessary it was to have this option there. So that, I would say, is the more typical, maybe a social contribution, maybe in that sense. But again, more something where it was discussed in the cooperatives, is this a helpful and necessary thing to do? And not really saying, okay, building a school sounds nice, so let's build a school, right? So that was not the approach there. So I would say the more unique thing is really that the local communities are doing a lot of the monitoring and so on themselves. I would say that is the biggest, the most unique educational element maybe of this project.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask more about that, because at least from my perception, especially in projects that tend to be funded through European Union and things like that, normally the monitoring and reporting takes up such a a huge amount of effort, and it actually takes away resources from being applied into the project. How do you think that this approach that you are doing to monitoring kind of affects the this element of monitoring and reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I won't deny that it still takes quite a bit of effort to do the monitoring and the reporting also to the carbon standards. And I think for good reasons, so that it's clear that if you claim to remove 1 ton of carbon, that is also really achieved. And it's not like just some like best guess or an estimation. So that is, of course, very, very important to do. And that's also why we, together with the partners, always decide to work with the most robust carbon standards, like in this case, the gold standard for the global goals, which is not just tracking and monitoring and verifying the carbon removal effect, but also the additional SDG impacts, where it's in their rules that you need to not just impact, but also monitor and by an auditor have verified additional SDG impacts beyond just the climate impacts. So that is one part, but on the other side, how to do that it's not an isolated exercise that takes away resources, but that basically creates as much value in itself as possible. That's where the part comes in of who does the monitoring, right? And those are jobs. So it's not like they are doing that necessarily just in their free time. There are jobs created to monitor those things. And so it basically brings the value or the costs to do this, brings them back into the communities because it generates those additional income. So this is like kind of the thing where we say, yeah, you can pay a consultant who flies in from Europe and does these things, or you can really think about how to do it maybe in a smarter way, not in the easier way, but in the more impactful way to approach this differently. Plus that some of the activities also on the forest are also done voluntarily, right? So that is another component, which again addresses the perceived ownership of the community. So that is, yeah, this is what we built, right? This is what we contributed to. But a lot of the more technical certification elements and so on then is basically done as employment opportunities as well.
Yeah, and since one other, so we've talked about all of the benefits that this has, I'm also curious about what have been the main challenges in implementing this type of project that you've come across over time?
Yeah, I mean, definitely some topics that were tricky to figure out over the years, I would say. I mean, I think you mentioned it earlier that, okay, now this is a carbon project. So what is a carbon project? That really took a few years, to be honest, for the communities to understand that really, like, okay, we are monitoring these things, and then like there's this carbon removal and someone is paying for it, but like who and how do we get the money and when? And I mean, that's not because they're not educated enough. I mean, that is a very, very abstract logic, of course. So that was in the early years, definitely a challenge where there needed a lot of trust to be built that this is actually something that creates those incomes, right? Because they say, okay, like we are removing carbon from the air. How is anybody paying for that? And there was a real level of hesitance, I would say, regarding that element. So that, again, that just took a lot of communication, definitely. And also it certainly was supported when the first results came in, right? So when actually the income arrived, when actually they could implement those activities because they saw the effect and the impact. I would say that is one thing. And the other thing is in the structure also of the cooperatives, who are the decision makers, things like gender equality, where obviously the balance between how things are traditionally done on the ground versus how also the more development aspects to find the right balance there, to not, again, not come in from the outside and say, this is how you now need to do it or you won't get any money. But at the same time, still trying to find the right balance of pushing some topics we consider, or also World Vision Ethiopia as our partner, consider important to work on and to find that right balance in this partnership. And that is an ongoing discussion, to be honest. There are certainly topics that we continue to address, also to make sure that the livelihoods that are created are really also upkept and are really sustainable, and that we avoid things like, okay, you now have a new flour mill maybe, but like you don't really use it. So it sounds like that you could say you build it, but if you're not using it, obviously it doesn't make any sense. So to work on these things, I wouldn't say is difficult, but it's certainly something that takes a continued effort, and where some of the challenges, especially in the early years, that we were facing.
Yeah, and I'm also curious, could you expand a little bit on kind of the timeline? How long is, because it seems like it's a process that takes some time. Could you explain a little bit about how the timeline of a project like this, or what's the timeline of implementation look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say there's those different phases. So the timeline, and we see that especially now with, as I said, where we try to replicate this model and scale it up and expand it to additional areas, where we basically start now where we might have been 15 years ago in the Zotto Humbo project, that you start having those discussions with the communities, that you start building the corporate structures and so on. I think in this approach, there's easily, I would say, a 2 or 3 year run up just even before you start implementing any activities, or before you start the first time to take an auditor to this area and show them what you want to do and how you want to structure it. And then just as it's a nature-based project, you have usually a time of 5 to 7 years, I would say, in this approach until you have any visible or any relevant effects in terms of carbon removals as well, right? So in this case, getting the underground forest into an above ground forest and really regrowing the biomass, it just takes some time. And that is why these projects usually run at least 30 years. So with Zotto Humbo, we are now at around the 15 year mark. And that's really, I would say, where the sweet spot is, basically, where it's okay, the forest is there, the forest is growing, it's really the most carbon removal is happening right now. We have the highest increases in biomass on an annual basis. The project is established, is well established on the community level. We have the revenues coming in, and this is where we need to build all the structures in this, I would say, like 5 to 20 year time frame. And then the last 5 to 10 years are really making sure that, again, the project is ready to self-sustain, because in these cases, the carbon certification in terms of additionality, where you need to demonstrate that the project is only happening because of the carbon revenue income, it usually ends after 30 to 50 years. It depends on the project type, but in this case, it would end in most cases after 30 years, where the goal is, again, to have the project in a situation where you don't need the carbon revenue anymore and it's still sustaining itself and the situation that has been achieved. So overall, I would say it's easily a 35 year perspective in order to then, again, have those impacts for 100, 200 years into the future, obviously. So I would say those are maybe the different phases in such a project.
Yeah, thank you for sharing so openly about it. And connected to this, so you have also mentioned and just did again how you are trying to replicate the project in other locations. So how scalable do you think that your model is? That how easily could it be applied in even other locations around the world outside of Ethiopia?
Yeah, well, I think it is extremely scalable, and that is really something where we need to give the complete credit to World Vision and Tony Rinaudo, who is really driving this concept. It's not something that we develop, but they are working on this. And it is actually, this farmer managed natural regeneration is also something that is happening actually in different countries all over the world, whether that's like part of this official FMNR program or not, because it just makes sense once you recognize that it's possible. It has evolved independently from each other, actually, in different countries, both in Africa, but also in other continents. what makes it so scalable is that the actual investment costs are not that high, because you don't need to prepare the land like in an industrial way. You don't need to bring in tree nurseries. You don't need to plant every tree that is supposed to grow there. You don't need to plant that individually in each case. You basically, this regeneration element is what makes it so scalable. Because yeah, of course it takes work, but the upfront costs compared to a traditional reforestation project, for example, or a tree planting project, are just much, much lower. But again, that is something that also the FMNR team is doing a lot of work around. They have, like, online you can find an FMNR hub, for example, with a lot of resources, a training guide, FAQs, best practice examples, where everyone can just go there and find the resources they need to try and do the same thing. So they are really, really open about sharing all their learnings and making this a more broadly applied technique, which is, I think, a really, really nice approach. But of course, in the end, to really scale it up also as the carbon project space always takes work and the cooperation of the right partners. But yeah, we're working on different countries currently to try and start more of these projects to secure still there is some pre-finance obviously needed to build the structures and to secure that and to start more projects as well. So in that sense, it is definitely, it has room to grow still way beyond where it is today.
Okay, so as we are moving more towards the end of the interview, I'm also going to ask you a couple questions that I ask every interviewee. And the first one is, would you say that you are hopeful about the possibility of solving this whole carbon climate crisis?
Well, that's a great question, actually. I would say yes, I mean, but mostly because what's the alternative, right? I mean, even if we are, I'm always thinking a bit in the way, if we are not hopeful that what's currently happening is really solving the situation, then that's a good reason to do whatever we can to improve it. And if we are hopeful, that means that we really need to continue pushing in order to make it come true. So in the end, it comes down to the same thing, to really drive this topic and do as much as we possibly can to address this challenge. But overall, I would say yes, hopeful, but I mean, certainly still a lot of work to do and a lot of question marks, and sometimes struggling to understand why there's not so much more happening. And it's a lot of commitments and a lot of talking about it, but then it's also very, very quickly not that high on the agenda, or if you need to make a real decision, then some other elements are more important all of a sudden. But we do see it, and we see it on the project implementation side, that there's so much dynamic happening right now. And we also see it on the supporter side with the commitments of corporates. And there's many, many more of them really thinking about how can we achieve the best impacts. Then it is about, okay, how can we make this look as good as possible? And really the large majority of them are really focusing on the right thing. So that is one of the things that really makes me hopeful that we are moving definitely in the right direction.
Yeah, great to hear that. And final question for people watching who have become inspired or want to contribute, how could they potentially help support the cause or even get involved?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one thing that is, if you want to be involved more, maybe on a project or on a content level, I think checking the resources, looking for the FMNR hubs, for example, is something to inform more about this work. And I think also share the story of this work. I think that's absolutely always a good way to support it. And then in the networks you're in the organizations you're in the companies you're working in and so on, really also there to keep bringing up this topic. And in the end, if it's about this specific approach, of course, that's always something where a connection, looking at again, the work that World Vision is doing and how to support that, because in the end, it's all connected at that level as well. So on an individual basis, I would say that is a good way to engage and to support this. And yeah, other than that, again, I mean, really looking at what is my employer maybe doing, what is our company doing, what is the organization that I'm volunteering in doing for this topic. And in the end, we always say, we do what we do because we think these are good and solid and sustainable approaches, and we want to do those as good as we can, which doesn't mean that all the other or most of the other activities in that space are not just as important, right? So if this topic of climate action is relevant to you, it's very, very valid to look at what you can do on an individual basis and what other topics maybe fit well to the work that your company is doing. So it's really whatever is possible, just go ahead and get some action done.
What a great message to end with. And thank you so much, Julian, for just sharing all of these insights from the work that you've been doing. It's been really wonderful conversation. And to everyone watching, we're going to drop in the description the links to For Alliance's work, to the Sodomo forestation project, and also to these resources that Julian was just mentioning, FEMNR, if I'm not mistaken. I hope I didn't get that wrong. So if you want to check those out, please take a look at the description. And thank you again, Julian, for a great conversation, really.
Thank you. It was great to be here and really, really interesting discussion. Thanks.
Thank you.